Joe, how you doing?
Just great, Tim. How are you? Good to hear your voice.
Very good. Back in, very good. Thanks. Okay. Well, we're back for another show here. Well, this week we've had a number of a couple of events. A couple of them really stick out. One was the bombing, the alleged suicide bombing at in Manchester at the Ariana Grande concert. And
Yes, Ariana Grande.
Ariana Grande, pop singer. I have to admit, I'm not a fan, so I can't talk much about her music or whatever they call it. From what I understand, she's very talented, but she, the music she performs leaves something to be desired, at least in my opinion. But that's not the story here. The story is that there was a bombing attack, a terrorist attack, at the ending of one of her concerts in Manchester, England. What are your thoughts on that event?
Well, first I want to digress and say, in the aftermath of the bombing, they had a lot of interviews with parents, and some of the parents had children that were very young, between 5 and 10 years old. And I just want to say these parents should basically be arrested for child abuse. I mean, if you look at the lyrics that Ariana Grande has, they're just basically as graphic and explicit as you can imagine, and so it's just another ratcheting down, I think, of culture. And I really wonder about kind of the psychological construction of the interviews with the parents, if in fact they aren't just part of the whole debasement, kind of normalizing. And almost pedophilia, in the sense that you have these little tiny kids attending a, this person that's using basically graphic sex metaphors to become popular. And so that part was interesting to me. First of all, I just thought that there was a relationship between all of the events. I mean, we had the normal week where you had terrorism and a technologic ratcheting up of the police state, right? These are the normal news items of our world. If you blinked, you might have missed the ratcheting up of the technologic police state. Theresa May, the bizarre British Prime Minister, said that they were basically going to have to control the internet. Very draconian censorship, and just taking government control. I mean, the description of the program she was laying out was basically the end of freedom on the internet. And so then immediately after this, you had the Ariana Grande event. It had some of the characteristics of false flags. I don't know if, in fact, it was. It certainly is should be considered as something that could be a false flag. They actually had a CNN mainstream talking head bring up the idea that the event had been staged by the Tories. In other words, that this guy was saying, well, maybe the Tories did it, because this would help them, win more conservative voters in the upcoming elections. And so then he was roundly, attacked by other people as being crazed. And so it all just that all fell by the boards. But he had brought up the possibility, and on mainstream media, that hey, this could just been a false flag. So, I wanted to just go over briefly, Tim, what I think should happen. When when our routine terrorist event occurs, I mean, there should be a protocol. The citizen should develop a protocol for trying to, get real news out. I mean, one thing is, if the area could be that the terrorist event occurs could be photographed, this should be done. One of the things that's kind of interesting to me about this event is that you don't get any pictures of it until basically the police have been in and have, kind of cordoned off the area, and you see, medical personnel and some of the purported victims lying around, you know, in various body parts and whatnot. Normal terrorist stuff, but you would think that there would have been iPhones in action right after the explosion, right? You've got 20 plus fatalities and supposedly 100 plus people who were seriously injured. Well, why weren't there 500 people then who were in proximity who could have photographed it? Because those pictures would have been really important. I think that in general, the terrorist events, whenever they can, they're faked because it's a lot easier to deal with, fictional fatalities. If you have real fatalities, then you get, you know, real parents and real family members and friends doing investigations. So if you can, I think in general, they like to do just completely fictional terrorist events. I mean, people have said Sandy Hook and the Boston Marathon, you know, were just basically constructed, right? There's nothing real there. People aren't being killed. There's just some smoke or whatever. And then you have it's called crisis actors. So that's the first thing the citizen should do is try to get photographs, you know, of the area as soon as possible. And particularly if you can get them immediately after the explosion has occurred. Now, if they don't come forward, then this is an enormous area that needs to be basically analyzed. Because like I pointed out here, like, where are the pictures? You know, I mean, every one of the people that was leaving an Ariana Grande concert has got an iPhone. So there should have been a lot of video of the events right afterwards, and there are none. I mean, the first things that I've seen are when they, you know, you have the police there and there's medical personnel and, you know, you have the normal terrorism TV show going on. But you don't get any of the what I would call, you know, primary documentation of the effects of the explosion. So that's number one, is that if you can get pictures, get them. If you can't get pictures, then try to find out why not. In other words, if someone had been alert, then this is, you know, an area where they were exiting the stadium. It wasn't that the explosion took place outside of the stadium. So what would have had to have occurred would have been they would have needed to cordon off an area where they could, you know, run the theatrical event. Well, that cordoning off, that separating the real crowd from what they're going to, you know, from the crisis actors, that could have been something that could have been photographed and documented. If an alert citizen researcher had been in the, you know, in the area, then immediately following that, there was evidently a noise, a loud noise has been recorded, right? They have a video of it shot from some distance, but it's just a little tiny, you know, it's not like a, you know, some kind of mushroom cloud. It's just a little burst of light and then a noise. But if a citizen researcher had been there, they could have gotten real documentation on how the area is cordoned off, who was involved. And the thing is, take videos of every single person that is associated in any way with authority around these things. All of these people should be documented so that then we can go back and determine who they are, because what I suspect is you're going to find them as part of, you know, these police, you know, government police agents, right? You're going to see someone with an usher's, you know, role. But in fact, if you have a picture of them and you can do some research, you're going to find out that this guy's actually just, you know, works for the NSA or the CIA or something like that, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the other thing, is that if you can get primary pictures, get them. If you can get pictures of the individuals who are operating as authority, get all of those. And then beyond that, they'll have, you know, what I would call pity creators. Like, they had these two girls that they interviewed, and a number of guys who have analyzed the interviews of the people who were had survived it, but who were supposedly close to the blast and saw all of the dead bodies and stuff. They have said that they find that the people in these videos are either, you know, have some problem with their identity. So that's what would be the next step, is that try to find out as much as you can about the identities of the individuals who are the pity creators. If it is just a false flag, then you'll get a lot of these individuals that will be able to be traced into crisis acting. Now, you're going to get a lot of them as well that'll be real. I mean, if they have this kind of event, people will be terrorized, and you can get legitimate people who have been terrorized. I think some of the mothers that had been told the event occurred and didn't know where their children were, who hadn't gone to the concert but were being interviewed later on, I mean, I think they were legitimately distraught. So there's going to be a blend. You know, they'll try to blend in as much realism as they can, but you know, a good researcher should be able to start parsing this stuff out. So basically, what I was hoping is that, you know, with the Manchester event, which has so many elements of, like, just it stinks of false flag. You know, it's timing relative to May's statement. It's the fact that it was a cordoned off area. You know, there was no videos of the actual, you know, blood running in the after the blast. I mean, this would have been a really great time for the citizen researcher to have been in there with the iPhone and creating, you know, the primary documentation that then researchers could analyze and vet after the fact. So those are my thoughts on Manchester. What did you think about it, Tim?
Well, first, your observation disregarding the concert itself, I think is interesting. This seems to be that one thing I noticed maybe 15, 20 years ago is just parents losing all discernment in these things in the entertainment sphere for their children, as the entertainment has become increasingly sexualized and introduced to younger children. We saw this with Britney Spears about roughly 20 years ago. Katy Perry, of course, her showing up on Sesame Street, this is introducing the stuff to kids. Of course, you know, she does with Elmo or something, a song parroting one of her songs. And of course, if you look at some of her other songs, they're highly sexualized, and it's not an appropriate mix for children. And you have children 5, 6 going to a concert and listening to the music and even, you know, the lyrics and these songs, or the entertainer herself, she's, you know, it's a typical Pop-Tart, right?
And so, debasing Pop-Tart. I mean, like Katy Perry on Sesame Street was wearing a low-cut top.
Yes. And you know? It's just, you know, it's in your face. And the children aren't, they're not getting any chance for, I don't know, just a moment of any latency period, you know,
and that's a process of some innocence.
Yes,
where you could develop the capacity for romance.
Yeah, there's no aesthetic.
They're taking these kids right into the pedophilic, X-rated, pornographic world when they're 5 years old. For God's sakes, it's disgusting. And the parents are either absolutely brain dead; they've just been completely culturalized away from any kind of parental responsibility, or they're actors. You know, they're basically setups, you know, that they're trying to use to socialize and normalize, you know, the sexualized children.
I just remember back when I was a teenager, and first of going to concerts wasn't something you did until you were a teenager.
Yeah.
Not 8 years old, not 7 years old. It's just, it wasn't even on my radar screen at 7 or 8. Music wasn't even on. I started getting the Beatles music when I was about 12 or 13, maybe 11, listening to my brother's albums, you know. So, but even then, the idea of going to concerts wasn't until you established some degree of independence, like you could pay for your own ticket and get a ride there, that sort of thing. So you're a little older, isn't to say those concerts weren't destructive in their own way. I'm not saying they were wholesome then, but I'm saying at least you're a little older. I remember my parents, particularly my mom, just saying, I'm not going to pay for a ticket. Those things are stupid. You know, just dismissing them. She certainly wouldn't have escorted me to the concert and paid, you know, which is it goes to show you the degradation, the dumbing down of society.
Yeah, that's right. It really does show it. Yeah.
The parents have to indulge and promote all this pop culture crap. When they could,
I saw this one woman, and she was talking about Ariana Grande, as this was something that the whole family was looking forward to doing, and she had like 5-year-old kids and stuff.
That's bizarre. I mean,
it's just insane, and it's I don't know what to make of it. It's they're either you know, just the sign that society is now reaching kind of the cesspool
yeah, and
era.
She's like 22, and she looks very young, and her music videos have a, you know, they're very suggestive of pedophilia. She dresses like a you know, like a tweener, like a 13-year-old or something. She looks very young for her age. You know, 22 is young, of course, but she, you know, and yeah, again, it's highly sexualized, so again, it's not appropriate entertainment for children. Yet parents today, at least many parents, not all of them, of course, many parents are disgusted by it as much as I am, but many aren't. That's, you know, why there's such a market for it. But they've been engineered through popular culture to believe that they have to, you know, facilitate this stuff, you know, make it so their kids can have access to this type of entertainment. The same reason why they're, you know, tricked into believing that they have to pay for, you know, smartphones for their children, and, you know, the internet, give them all access to the internet, or even to, you know, cable television, the stuff. You have to have all this entertainment stuff for their children. They really don't. And the medium is the message, is, you know, Marshall McLuhan once said. And, you know, that's...
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, Tim, do you mind if I just read some of the lyrics from Ariana that I think people should be aware of so they can really put this, the kind of debate we're talking about, in the right context?
Yeah, let's see what... Let's hear what...
yeah, I'll just read you some of them. This is like... This one is from her Christmas song, right? Are you down for some of these milk and cookies? You'll be my drummer boy, and I'm the only drum that you're going to play. And whatever is on your list, I'll do it. Boy, whatever it is, you know I'll do it. Merry Christmas. Here I am, boy. I'm the present, and you know it, boy. I'll give you the fire I keep inside. Guide you all the way down, be your nightlight. We don't need no presents. I mean, notice the grammar. We yeah. don't need the kitchen. We don't need them recipes. You know, I'm tasty like a candy cane or gingerbread. Now,
not Silent Night.
Oh, you caught me up by surprise with that one, brother. Yeah, that's right. This isn't, you know, Hark the Herald Angels Sing. I mean, this is just, you know, pedophilic promotion, right? I mean, your Christmas is being pornographicized.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So this is what the parents were taking their kids to, the 10-year-olds to, you know.
Now, as far as the event itself,
yeah,
you mentioned this is a, of course, a justification for an expansion and intensification of the police state. You have Theresa May. I think her previous post was Home Secretary, and she's the one that oversaw the implementation of the sort of this Orwellian surveillance state that the United Kingdom lives under today.
Right.
But she, in the wake of these attacks, she suspends the parliament, the general elections, and she announces, of course, I think thousands of troops are now going to occupy the streets. This also,
it's a police state, basically, yeah. Martial law.
Despite the fact that, of course, I think I've made this point before, is if you're going to assume this was a suicide bombing, I don't know how more troops are stop that from happening, but needless to say,
well,
you know,
yeah.
You've had the militarization of the police in Great Britain. It used to be unarmed. I was listening to a talking about in Scotland, how just a few years ago, it was a big controversy to have armed police, just have armed police on the streets. Now this will legitimize it. And they were showing this Twitter campaign of various people smiling next to these heavily armed cops, like saying, thanks for keeping us safe. Everyone just smiling.
Yeah. They just love their slaver,
you know? And so it's a whole Twitter campaign to legitimize this. The same way we've had the militarization of the police here in the United States, you know, that all started back in the '70s, but it intensified, after 9/11, largely a function of the phony drug wars. Same way it's a function of the phony war on terror. It's all about a strategy of tension. And, you know, looking at an attack like this, and of course the attacker was identified as a Libyan, I believe, a Libyan of descent. His father emigrated from Libya in 1980, I think.
Yeah.
as a political refugee, and it's a Salman Abedi, I think it was the name, the attacker, according to reports. And well, he, interesting enough, as some people have tracked, and he actually, 1913, he traveled back he into Jordan and Syria. And there's some speculation that he might have been part of a British training program to fight as a proxy soldier in the Middle East, and then also he returns back. Friends say he was kind of fun-loving, happy-go-lucky guy, and he came back a rather serious person, espousing extremist beliefs, which is what this program is designed to do. Because if you look at the history of British geostrategy and also American U.S. geostrategy, it's to promote Islamic fundamentalism, particularly in those countries, to destabilize and weaken those countries, but also here in the States and also here in Great Britain, to also as a part of a strategy of tension, which is a that term goes back to Operation Gladio. False terrorist attacks back in the 60s to the 1980s that were conducted by NATO and various fascist groups to carry out false flag terrorist attacks, blaming it on communists, Red Guards, Baader-Meinhof, these groups, to bring stability through destabilization, as one of the Gladio soldiers said. I think it was Vincenzo Vinciguerra. He said that the idea was to target the children, target women, target innocent people, to maximize terror, to create a maximum amount of instability in order to stabilize the political situation. It's called a strategy of tension. So there's a
Yeah,
pattern here.
I mean that's exactly right. Although what they want is a justification for a police state.
Yeah. Which is what they're advocating. We could Theresa May talking about more troops, more security measures. Even in France, was it Emmanuel Macron, the new president?
Yeah.
He wants to now this, although this attack occurred in Great Britain, he's using it as a pretext to extend the state of emergency that has been in place in France for a few years, going back to the it was a terrorist attacks a couple of years ago. So they keep extending them with every event. Of course, this what this does is this cancels warrants and other procedural rights that citizens have. They can warrantless searches. They can do warrantless eavesdropping, which they're doing anyway. They'll do it anyway. So I don't even know if it makes a difference, but it's they admit it.
Yeah. I mean, what will it take for the people to realize that they've been enslaved, that they're living in a police state? The rationales are getting weaker and weaker, and the responses are getting, more and more draconian and last longer and longer. And soon there'll just be a, so-called perpetual terror response, which will basically just militarize, every city in Western civilization. And this will occur if the citizens don't become aware that the plan is in motion and start to resist. How, I'm not sure, but the first step would be information. We've got to get information out. We have to, the citizen needs to understand that the government is fake. It's not a reflection of democracy. That's all controlled through the control of the media. And the people that you see as leaders, so-called, are in fact lifetime actors. And what is really happening is that the technological surveillance and enslavement state is coming into existence. And it's not going away, it's once it's in, it's in. So the more cameras, the more militarized police. I mean, see, Tim, the problem with all this, it isn't, just that they're going to make sure that everybody, uses the salad fork. I mean, this isn't going to be, like they're going to be asking for small changes in behavior with the police state. What the reason they need to do this is because they're going to reduce population. That means us. We're going to get culled. We're going to be genocided. And so the police state is being set up now so that they can control the resistance when the population gets onto the deal, when they start realizing that, everything is a weapon designed against us, the food, the media, the politics. and people start acting out. That's why they're putting this police state into effect now with all the cameras and everything, you know, being controlled, so they can basically deal with the resistance that they know is going to come as soon as people start catching on to what's happening.
Yeah. Now, with this, well, one thing is we have to whether or not this this particular attack, they've arrested, I believe, his two brothers.
Yeah.
Which happened with the, I think the arrest was happened to occur just when the media was there to film it for everyone to see.
Yeah.
You know, so it's an event. It's a media event. But the question is, you know, we've had a number of attacks and attempted attacks, and they've always linked to some. I mean, you had 7/7, which was linked to a drill, and of course, the whole 7/7 narrative is not really tenable because certain facts don't match up. A good example is the attackers. Remember the film of them going into the train station. It turns out they weren't on the train, so they couldn't have been where they were for the attacks to occur. The Luton train, I think, was a detail there. I think in the subway, the tube attacks, you had explosions that occurred. The damage from the explosion was inward. And the
right.
claim was there were suicide bombers in the train, which means the damage would have been outward. So you have a problem with the forensic evidence there. Here in the States, you know, we have Trevor Aronson's book, The Terror Factory, and he studied like close to 500 incidences or investigations of supposed attempted attacks, and all of them, except for a handful, were for FBI sting operations.
Yeah, they always seem to have a government agency with a drill that enables them basically to control the physical narrative, you know. They can have someone there who's telling people what they're seeing.
Or the attackers have some link to intelligence. They're known to intelligence.
Yeah.
Like the Finsbury Mosque in London is just filled with British intelligence. I think that Abu Hamza was an informant in these things. So these mosques are created for a reason. They're radicalized intentionally by the intelligence agencies to create these incidents. You know, to justify the budgets, to ratchet up the fear, strategy of tension.
Yeah.
So it's an old, you know, it's not something that's new. This goes back to, you know, in Afghanistan, when, you know, we stirred up Muslims to fight the Soviets, and we did it in the Caucasus against the Soviet Union, the Balkans, and these things. But the irony is all these wars abroad, it's another important point, is that these people are coming from destabilized areas in North Africa and the Middle East. These are wars that are fomented by the United States, by NATO, by the Atlanticist powers. At the same time, they're destabilizing these areas, creating these civil wars, which is causing an exodus into Europe. They're, and bringing in the very people who might carry out these attacks. And I don't think that the people who are doing this are stupid. I think they know exactly what they're getting, because you might get some genuine attacks. You also get the rapes and the crime and all the other problems to stir up this mess to create what you've called a gladiatorial pit. They're creating conditions for civil war intentionally.
Exactly right. That's exactly what they're doing. They are putting in basically uneducated and terrorized Islamic males into European culture, so-called, who have no real skills or very few skills that they can find employment with at a time when the economy is very fragile anyway. Mm-hmm. And then they will watch as the violence pops up. The violence is a twofer. I mean, one, it creates hatred. And then two, it creates justification, you know, so that they can just say, well, yeah, we have cameras all over your house, and we have an armed guard with an AR standing in front of your front door. But don't you feel better?
Yeah,
isn't this something that's you know makes you happier because you now have you have security?
You're all warm and cozy inside. They have these Twitter pictures where people are hugging this RoboCop, and they're just smiling.
That's right.
Two thumbs up. Oh, isn't this love? They're all dressed in black. With automatic weapons.
Well, you know what's interesting is that one thing I've noticed is that the counter-terrorist squads are now all looking basically the same. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, back in the beginning of, you know, the 21st century, if you look at the police departments, you could tell like a British from a French from an American. Now basically they all have this kind of militarized Praetorian guard. You know, they've got a giant chest protector and a helmet, an AR, and then pants that have like 20 weapons hanging from the sides of them, you know. And they all look the same, basically. You could just so the population is getting, you know, normalized to this idea of a worldwide police state that is heavily armed and will blow your head off if you know, you speak out against the fact that you've been enslaved. So,
and the fact that your neighbor could be a terrorist.
Yeah, that's right.
Everyone is a suspect. You see something, say something. The most ridiculous things.
We've mentioned this before. We've talked about it. But, I mean, something's got to give. Because if you look at the collapse in the public's trust of the mainstream media, and I've been studying this, and it's just absolutely collapsing. Mm-hmm. I think it has a lot to do with 911. I think that 911 is not characterize honestly in terms of the statistics, but at least as they purport them, you know, you have 50% of the population now doesn't buy the government story. So that's a pretty powerful platform. I mean, that's something from which you could actually create rebellion. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of shutting down the internet or turning into simply a government propaganda device, which is what Theresa May, if you actually parse Theresa May's words and go, well, what is she actually saying? I mean, what she's saying is that the internet will be nothing but a government propaganda device. That's all it will be. That will be the only thing that will be available. And that's why when you look at Facebook and Twitter and, you know, I mean, you can then now see that these are actually just government cutouts. You know, they're not there for any other reason but to just get people conditioned into a certain kind of social activity on the internet, which is completely monitored and controlled. And so this is what Theresa May's vision is. And and so this is because, I believe, the results of the internet have been unanticipated. And I think that the alternative media, you know, which of course is now characterized as fake news, the term that they invented to try to keep people from using this source of information. You know, it's just getting too many people buying into it, because when people listen to it, they can tell that the people presenting the information, they may not always be right, but I think people have the capacity to detect sincerity. I think this is, you know, it's sort of like humans have odd sensory capacities. I mean, we're very good at detecting purity in water, for example. We can, you know, detect parts per million of certain kinds of things. You know, the brain really has some capacity for detection of things which are necessary to be able to be healthy, you know. And I think one of the things that people can do is they can detect sincerity. And I think when people see like Wolf Blitzer or Sean Hannity, you know, these kind of guys, they can just tell that it's just BS, that they're lying their heads off. They're actors. They're good actors, right? And they probably believe what they're saying, and they probably, you know, have lots of stuff that they say are that are actually facts to some extent. But they also know that overall they're just propaganda devices. And it comes out from time to time and just, you know, their eye movements, their, you know, the way that they just let on that they're lying. I mean, people who play poker a lot, I like to play poker. I think it's fascinating, you know, because you're trying to read the heart of the person you're playing with, right? And they're little tiny tells, you know, and you don't even know sometimes, like, what exactly is it that makes you think a person is bluffing, you know, but I think that there are kind of unconscious processes that detect sincerity. And I think that, for example, like I always talk about how much I like listening to your voice. I just love listening to it. And you know, I think why? Because I think you're telling the truth. I just get this feeling like, gosh, it's such a relief to listen to Tim. I don't like to listen to Wolf Blitzer. He gives me a headache. He's always lying. I don't like to listen to the prostitutes with the blonde hairs and all these people at Fox News, because they just sent, I mean, that isn't just my political perspective. Even before 911, they gave me a headache. I could just tell they were fake, you know? So that's why I think they've really got to clamp down on the internet, because frankly, there are just too many bloody people starting to catch on from the information that's being put out that there is something really wrong with government.
Yeah. Now, another thing that occurred this week, I think it's related. We had Donald Trump's, President Trump's trip to the Middle East.
Yeah.
He was partying with some Saudis, the Saudi royal family, and giving a speech.
Yeah, doing a knife dance.
Yeah, and he urged the Saudis to chase out the terrorists, chase out the extremists from their camp. And well, the funny thing is, the Saudis, the Gulf states, they're the main promoter of Islamic radicalism, at least Wahhabism, and they have a whole network of madrasas that promote this radicalism. I think part of the deal they have for paying for some of the madrasas throughout the world, particularly in the United Kingdom, is that the imam has to be Saudi approved. So there's a whole process there. But this is all the U.S. knows this, and the U.S. knows that that the Saudis and the Gulf states, these things, they're the main promoter of Wahhabi Islamic fundamentalism. Yet Donald Trump goes there. Seals a $100 billion arms deal with them, which is all part of the sweet little deal we've had with the Saudis since the 1970s. Then he starts criticizing Iran as being a source of terrorism.
Yeah, I know.
In his
right.
own speech, he admits that the Saudis are a source of this stuff. ISIS, Al Nusra, these things—they're all supported by the Saudis. They operate out of Turkey, which is NATO. The fact that NATO and the Western powers are trying to unseat the Assad regime in Syria, President Assad in Syria, an elected government that has the broad support of the Syrian people, that ISIS is trying to overthrow them. So in Syria, we're supporting ISIS, but then we hear that these attacks in Europe are either ISIS linked or ISIS inspired. We have to engage in doublethink in order to accept.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I mean, ISIS is just the same thing as the 9/11 terrorists. It's just a production of the Western Masonic government, to have a controlled opposition to create the terrorism that they're then going to use to have the justification for the police state. When Putin came into Syria and he started blowing up ISIS, the oil tankers, right? Mm-hmm. ISIS was making about $100 million a month in oil sales, right? It's expensive to run the gigantic terrorist activity in the Middle East, making about $100 million a month is what they estimated. And it was all through Turkey.
Was Erdogan's son selling it, though? Erdogan?
Well, no, what they would do is they would transport it from Syria in areas that they controlled in Iraq, and they would transport it by tanker to Turkey. And then supposedly Erdogan's son was involved in a company that then would resell it. And so Putin just started blowing up these tankers. And this was, very effective. And then notice since then that ISIS has basically, in terms of the Middle East, has just it's not really a factor as far as any can tell. Mm-hmm. So they had this CIA talking head. I think it may have been Clapper. I have to check it. But it was one of the CIA guys. And he was on, some kind of talking head show on a Sunday. And the interviewer asked him, look, why didn't we blow up these tankers? Right. Why didn't we stop ISIS's $100 million a month funding process? And the guy goes, well, it's because we were worried about the environment. I'm not kidding. This actually occurred. I mean, it was just the most bizarre thing. He said, well, blowing up the tankers, you got to worry about the environment. Now, you got to remember, this was a guy who was part of the organization that has dumped like 3,000 tons of depleted uranium into the region, right?
Yeah.
They use the depleted uranium to burrow through all of the protective areas that these guys are hiding in.
That stuff just toxifies
the environment for 1,000 years. And they've used thousands of tons of this crap. So this was obvious. It's just crude sophistry. And yet the American public just sits there and takes it. Right. They just went, no, okay. That, I guess you were just CIA was worried about the environment, so okay, we don't take out the tankers. I guess Putin doesn't care about the environment, so he's blowing them up. And then you mentioned one thing I always point out whenever I talk about Wahhabism is that you got to remember that Saudi was created by the same group, same individuals that created Israel. Right. If you actually look at, how does this whole process work? Who's in back of it? It's the same Masonic club that puts this thing into effect. And one thing I've done some research in, but I'm not really at a point where I can draw hard conclusions, but I will just mention the concern is that a lot of people are suggesting that the Saudi royal family is Jewish. There are researchers in the Middle East. One guy who evidently brought out some research has purportedly been executed by the Saudis. But the idea is that they were called something like hidden Jews or secret Jews, right? And that this was the basis for the Masonic organization of what we know as Saudi Arabia, and for the creation of the Wahhabism, kind of extreme position in terms of political control and just leading to the conflicted Middle East that we have now. And so the question is, was this always basically the plan? And then when you get to 1999 and the PNAC document, and they talk about, well, we've got to take out this country and that country, and they're talking about how they're going to basically create Eretz Israel, the boundaries that the Maccabees had from the Nile to the Euphrates, and all of these countries are being described in the PNAC document for what they refer to as full spectrum dominance, which I would interpret as just, genocide, basically. There's not a whole lot of distinction between what they describe and just genocide. In fact, to digress, I mean, in the document, and this is something that's signed on to by Biden and Cheney and all the neocon guys. They say, well, what we really need here is a ethnic specific bioweapon. We really need one of those, right? So you can just see that this is not, a group that is trying to implement democracy. I mean, an ethnic specific bioweapon against the non-Israelis. Well, if you're into that level of kind of moral depravity, what are you really incapable of, And inside, this is something that's on Wikipedia. This isn't like the ethnic specific bioweapon. It's should get more publicity, but it's actually right in the document. Just chilling. Anyway, so when you get to the condition we have now, it's you really have to look back all the way to the creation of Saudi Arabia and just say, well, what we have was planned, it was designed. And we're now looking at basically, sort of another phase of the whole process.
This was Kim Philby's father. He was instrumental in this. Of course, there's T.E. Lawrence. We all know that through the Lawrence of Arabia movie. But this is British geostrategy in the area, which was largely a Rothschild plan.
Rothschilds and Masons.
Rothschild
There's
and
nothing
Mason.
else. I mean, if you look at you, I mean. You'd be hard pressed to find someone that isn't directly under the control of the Rothschilds or a well-known Mason. I mean, Lawrence, T. Lawrence is, I mean, there you go. It's just all of these clowns down there are from this coalition that has some strange kind of basis for existence, because like you had mentioned that there seems to be something going on between kind of the Rothschild world and the Mason world. There's some kind of relationship. You can see it everywhere in these things. And the question is, what is it, right? How do they how what is the agreement that they have? What do they understand about one another? This is where the citizen researcher needs to step up and do the work.
Well, this is the geostrat—I mean, the imperial strategy of not just the British Empire, but the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century, when Britain and the United States had this rapprochement, and this was largely Rothschild inspired. If you look at the Commodore Perry's trip to Japan, And he had ties to the Rothschilds. I believe he had married into the Rothschild family through August Belmont, who was rumored to be an illegitimate son of the Rothschilds, I think. I think it was his
daughter.
Well,
he was there. He was exactly that is the claim. And he was the steward of their financial world in the United States. He owned the New York Times, and then he also owned, obviously, Belmont Racing Track. Mm-hmm. But the most important thing about August Belmont is that his business partner was Winston Churchill's grandfather.
Yes.
His daughter then is Jenny, who marries Churchill's father, I think in an arranged marriage, and then out pops Winston.
That's right. And Jenny, from what I understand, led quite a life.
Yeah, Winston Churchill, he was just he was so great for Western civilization with firebombing civilians, right? Total war. And then he was in the trenches in World War I. He was one of the guys with the pistols that would shoot you if you decided it wasn't a good idea to walk into automatic weapon fire.
Well,
so,
yeah, critical thought is, does not work on the battlefield.
No.
You can't get men charging me automatic weapon fire if they're critically thinking. Wait a second. But Winston Churchill is a great example of sort of that their corrupt British elite who were heavily indebted to the Jewish creditors, particularly the Rothschilds, his father, and also Winston, because they because of their moral debauchery, they'd gotten so far in their debt that the British state had pretty much had been taken over by these bankers, in this case the Rothschilds, and the British Empire, or at least the latter half of the British Empire, was largely a Freemasonic Rothschild project, so.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and then, of course, you have the combine, the East-West trading companies, the ones that the U.S. created and the ones that the Rothschild Masonic Guild created, and they were unified. They were in cooperation with one another. They both worked together, to create the Opium War. Mm-hmm. And of course, you got to remember that when you say slavery, I mean, this was their basic trade. They sold slaves. That's what they did. And they also created the opium addict. So you have a kind of moral perspective on humanity that is just about at the lowest rung imaginable. In other words, they basically take the position that they can just kill everybody that gets in their way for any particular reason. I mean, if you're, this really should be a subject of more, historical research. But I mean, just look, and not just the slavery, which people know about, but the idea of creating a quarter of the Chinese males were addicted to opium at one point. Mm-hmm. And then when they tried to resist, you send the gunboats up to kill the armies that are trying to prevent the opium from coming in. The guy who was in charge of it, Lord Palmerston, is the head Freemason in the Orient, right? Mm-hmm. And also a Rothschild ally. There is the, your weird, somehow this group somehow has a way to organize itself. But the moral perspective is absolute genocide to all humans that are not in the guild. And it just every single time, occurs over and over again. If you are not in this secret guild, then your head is on the chopping block. They somehow just have created the moral authority and have it widely disseminated among all of the adherents of the group that the genocide of unwanted humanity or humanity that is not in the guild is not just warranted, not just justified, but it's the plan, right? So that's why, that's the kind of urgency I would hope that, people that listen to the show and do research and, come to their own conclusions and realize this is correct. This is the kind of urgency you need to bring to this because, this has been going on. When you see like 9-1-1 with all the Masonic symbolism and thousands of people being killed, I mean, you're looking at a recent event in a string of events that's hundreds of years old. And the whole genocide of European population in the 20th century, which was the century of the Gentile Holocaust, where a rounding error, right, of how many people died, how many Europeans died in war during this bizarre century, would be like 10 million, you know, rounding error. They don't know. I have no idea. You know, go and try to find out. 80 million, 200 million. They have no clue. No one counted the bodies. You know, you have estimates of the Holodomor, the starvation that was done by the Jewish individual Yagoda, you know, in the 20th century. And you get estimates from like 20 million, right? I mean, it's like could be 30, could be 5. Who knows? Who counted them, Tim? Nobody counted these bodies. They just died and that was the end of it. So that's what we're dealing with. And that's why if you are sitting around feeling a little uncertain, a little impoverished, a little like, well, you know, culture's not really working out for me very well. This is why, you see. This is why there's no happiness, no sense of solidity. This is why, you know, when you know, I mean, like people like you and I that had like the middle class upbringing kind of remember, you know, a European culture in, you know, that had some power, it had some capacity, right,
to defend itself. Confidence.
We look at something like the MTV, you know, Music Awards, right? This is, we've basically, you know, we're being run by the Whore of Babylon now. What happened? You know, this doesn't seem right. How did this occur? Well, it's the program. Mm-hmm. It's not history. History's not unfolding. It's a plan that's being executed.
Yep. Now, I think it might be related to all this is this story regarding the murder of Seth Rich.
Yeah, this interesting,
DNC,
isn't it?
Staffer who has been identified as a leaker, a primary leaker, to WikiLeaks regarding the Jean Podesta emails, which exposed so much and created so much controversy, and they run up to the election, even after the election, with the Pedogate or Pizzagate scandals, all the corruption, the intrigues against Bernie Sanders. Apparently, one of the motivations for his leaking might have been because he was a Bernie Sanders supporter, or he saw something really disturbing in these emails. Supposedly leaked some 44,000 emails and 17,000 attachments to WikiLeaks. And just after this is in July 10th, I think he's murdered about 4 in the morning walking home from a bar. He's shot twice in the back. He, according to police reports, he was conscious at the scene talking to officers. He was transported to the hospital, and an hour and a half later, he was dead. Some say, I heard some reports, some doctors said that his treatment left something to be problematic at the hospital. He had no vascular difficulties, yet he died, which seems to suggest he may have been assassinated. Now, there's also the important dimension of this is the Seth Rich. If he is indeed the leaker for the Jean Podesta emails, that undermines the Russia hacking meme, which has been utilized to delegitimize or Trump administration, create a dysfunctional political situation in Washington, D.C. And this whole hysteria regarding Russian hacking, whatever that means. No idea. To me, if Russia did hack the DNC emails and released the information, they did the American people a favor. You know, but
of course,
it doesn't bother me at all if Russia hacked it. You know, the DNC emails doesn't bother me. They released information. No one's really challenging the information or the veracity of the emails or their content of the emails. They're just saying who the source was or what the source was. Or in this case, it looks like Seth Rich might have been the source. That's what Julian Assange alluded to, I think, in an interview with Sean Hannity. And some people have now believed that he was assassinated for this, because one of the emails John Podesta calls for making an example of a leaker. So what's your take on all this?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I saw an interview with Seth Rich's family that basically didn't sit well with me. They had the kind of body language of actors. You know, I was mentioning this strange sense I get about people who are lying. You know, you have to wonder what really is in back of all this. This one of the concerns I have is that basically we're just looking at a kind of a complex theatrical event that's put on by the government to basically take people into kind of positions where it's hard to think clearly. you look at the charge, which is that Seth Rich w leaked, to WikiLeaks that he was the one, and certainly Julian Assange underlined this in kind of a cryptic way. I don't know if you listened to that, but Assange basically was
Yes.
saying that yes, he's the one, but I'm not going to say that he's the one, right? So it's very odd the way Assange outed Rich. However, if Rich was the individual, then it's almost axiomatic that the murder was an assassination because, the chances
The
of
timing, yeah.
that kind of a bizarre murder occurring to this individual who would release the WikiLeaks just seems completely crazy. So it would be far more likely that it would just have been kind of a routine assassination. But I just wonder if the whole thing isn't fake. I just wonder if the whole thing isn't just a way to kind of create a Monica Lewinsky distraction from, things that are more sinister. I don't really trust Seth Rich. I don't really, certainly don't trust his family. They did not look real to me when they were being interviewed about. They kind of reminded me of some of the people who were coming out after the Sandy Hook thing. Their just demeanor was not right.
Yeah, it was weird. They're like Mickey Mouse statues behind them or something.
Yeah, well, the
Figurines.
panda.
A
Well, panda,
panda.
because Rich supposedly liked pandas, and so
Yeah.
the mother's holding a panda. I mean, give me a break. And so this is all troubling, and I just think,
Well, they
now
hired
you have
him.
Hannity. Now
Yeah,
Hannity
Han,
comes
yeah.
forward, and he says, this could be a an assassination, and now everyone is beating up on Hannity, saying, oh my God, you're fake news. And so fake news is getting a bad name. And now what I would wonder if it's a theatrical production, there might be some kind of conclusion that will basically really, give the impression that the people who are bringing up the conspiracy, because notice it's been brought up by two media individuals. There was a guy on CNN who brought up the possibility, and now Hannity, and I guess Hannity's been put on forced vacation because of his bringing up this possibility that Rich was assassinated. But I mean, let's face it, Hannity is an absolute lifetime actor.
Yeah, so I have no, I mean, it's
Yeah,
like
so I think the idea that he's doing something here, like, wow, let's reveal to the public the truth. I mean, I just think, nah, I think the whole thing is fake, and you're going to get basically the if I, I mean, here's a scenario. The guy who killed Seth Rich will come forward, and you'll have a confession, and then everybody who had this the idea of conspiracy will have egg on their face,
Yeah.
and then the public will be conditioned into thinking that conspiracy theory is fake news. I mean, that's pretty crude, but that just was kind of the thought I had when I saw the family being interviewed, and I saw the mother holding a panda. I mean, give me a break, just. So I think we're. I think, Tim, what we're going to see is that just more and more of the events that will appear in front of the media are going to be designed as more complex theatrical productions.
Yeah.
There'll be twists and turns to the story, and media characters will fall or rise, this is all just there is a purpose to all of it, obviously. There in back of it, there are, they have their cluster of psychiatrists and psychologists and people who are doing, all of the testing and focus groups to determine exactly how to keep the population's mind in the place they want it to be while the genocide's going on. But I don't buy it, brother. I'm sorry. I don't. I don't
Well,
see it as
yeah,
real.
I mean, you've had a string of deaths. You also, that was it Sean Lucas, who was that process server,
Yeah.
who I believe knew Seth Rich.
I think so.
Which, so
Yeah.
you have the deaths of two young men. I mean, relating to this email,
Dropping like flies, yeah.
what are the odds of that occurring? Then you have the police saying, well, it was a botched mugging, robbery, which nothing was taken. Well, what's the evidence for it being a botched robbery? The fact the guy was shot. Obviously, when you have a political operative who's shot dead in the streets in the early morning hours, it's a political event. It's You can't help but
Yeah, I mean,
politicize
the
it. I
thing is,
mean, don't politicize it. Well, he's a
right.
political
And the, but
operative.
you know, the powers that be, they could handle something like this a lot cleaner if they wanted
That's what I'm saying is why would it be so botched? I mean, why did other than
Yeah.
the fact that maybe you want the controversy? That's where I
Exactly. Yeah.
exactly you want
Yeah.
the controversy. It's like I mean, they can kill someone with a heart, you know, like they got, you know, they can give someone a heart attack if they want, you know.
Yeah, they can. There's 100 ways to get rid of them, and the way they did it just basically added to the underlined the WikiLeaks as being something really important, and
which again, you know, WikiLeaks is very questionable.
Yeah,
yeah, their absolutely. Function in all this, because this stuff we're dealing in, you know, dialectics and trielectrics and quadrilectrics and manipulation. Your point about psychological warfare is very important because vast resources, millions and millions of man hours, technology has been devoted to psychological warfare. I mean, that's yep. mass communication. And I think it was Eisenhower when brought on C.D. Jackson back in his administration in the early 50s. It was the, you know, the Psychological Strategic Bureau, I think.
Yeah.
You know, we're designed to manipulate public opinion through the manipulation of information, the handling of information, the manipulation of the arts, the weaponization of the arts, promoting, you know, jazz music, promoting folk music, using folk music, you know, promoting rock music, promoting drugs. You and Jan Ervin have written about that with Life yeah. magazine, and C.D. Jackson goes right back to the Lifetime Life Empire, using the media. So all these institutions that we think are intermediaries or checks on these the powers that be aren't. They're all co-opted, they're all utilized, they're all tools, whether it's the network news media, the police force. I was reading a blog at National Review about this crazy conspiracy theory regarding Seth Rich, but he was murdered. Well, he was murdered. The question whether it was a political hit or not. And he's saying some crazy theories are out there that says that, you know, the police, the CIA, the news media are all working together to cover the story up. I was thinking, well, whether or not it's true or not, that's not a crazy conspiracy theory, because that's how they operate. That's tradecraft. If you know how intelligence agencies sure. operate, they infiltrate police departments, they infiltrate the media, they infiltrate other various government bureaucracies, you know, for years, so they have their men in place so they can do these things. And as this person who's writing this blog knew nothing about how they operate. They infiltrate.
It's sad, isn't it? Yeah, there's so little. It's fortunately now it's getting to be something the public is being made aware of. You know,
I mean, look at the RFK assassination. How the LAPD covered that up with the collusion with the CIA. If you have to investigate that, and you know, this goes back to the drug trade and how the intelligence agencies need to manage the drug trade for various strategic reasons. You know, back in World War II, the SS got involved in the heroin market, the opium market, because during the Civil War, I mean, during the war in Asia, the nationalist Chinese were actually trading opium with the Japanese, you know, so supposedly they're fighting each other, okay? So the OSS gets involved in that to manage the, you know, the war against Japan. So they have to take over the opium trade. And this gets into Vietnam, and the OSS has to push out CIA, then the OSS, then CIA nudge out the French to take control of the opium market to handle, you know, the situation in Vietnam. And that becomes an important part of a secret war at Laos, Cambodia, and funding the war. Pretty soon, all those covert operations, the money is, of course, funneling through Mexico into Las Vegas and into Los Angeles. And these are funding, this is a source of black op money, unvouchered fund operations for intelligence operations. Of course, we all know what happened with Iran-Contra. The big cocaine thing, you know. But the point is that pretty soon the covert is controlling the overt. It's the tail starts wagging the dog. Okay, the tail starts wagging the dog here. And so this is why police departments were infiltrated with intelligence agents and counter-narcotics officers, not to shut down the narcotics operation, but to manage it in a certain way that's beneficial towards the powers that be, the intelligence operations. And these law, like a murder here and there, get covered up because if you really investigate the murder, it'll expose a drug informant or an operation that's going down. It happens all the time in law enforcement, where there's a murder and the homicide detective will investigate it, do his due diligence, then told to back off because if he does investigate, he'll uncover a counter-narcotics operation, which is really a drug-running operation being conducted by the CIA. And in collusion with organized crime.
Yeah, and this would, so this would be something that the citizen researcher should, an area of focus is that local law agencies should be canvassed and asked to disclose whenever they're being maneuvered by larger agencies. So the public can start to learn that our local sovereigns, you know, the local police are basically in a puppet situation to mm-hmm. the federal government.
Yeah,
I mean, that's something I think the citizen needs to be more focused upon, more made aware of more concretely. Yeah. And so that's just a really good area, is to see if you can find local police people that will spill the beans about exactly how the federal jurisdiction dominates them. And it's really important because, remember, this is all going to go back eventually to the police state, you know, yeah, where, you know, the local sheriff will be replaced by the guys with the helmets and the ARs and the gigantic vests and stuff, you know. So it's time for the citizen to try to, you know, gain more information and understanding and control over local law enforcement. That's kind of one of our first lines of defense. So I think it'd be great if we could get some interest, you know, in that. You know, getting back to Rich, you know, this is just another place that the citizen researcher can learn, you know, how to make progress more quickly. And one of the things I was going to say is that, you know, the principle of habeas corpus should be really strong in the citizen researcher. Like with Seth Rich, the first thing we want to do is find the body, right? Is he dead?
That's right.
You know, I don't know if you've seen, like, with John Lennon, you know, they have this Lennon impersonator, and some people have done research into the guy, and they say, you know, he isn't an impersonator, it's Lennon, right? That whole thing was faked, it seems like. And now I don't know if this is true. I haven't done enough research to have an opinion, but the idea of staging murders for the purpose of, you know, control the population and affecting culture, that makes perfect sense to me. So the first thing was something like Seth, and particularly after he had the bizarre interview with the parents and the brother, which I thought was just crazy. You know, the brother was sitting there smiling the whole time. We've got to find the body. You know, does someone have an actual place? I mean, where is it? Let's have habeas corpus, right? If the government wants to give us these elaborate theatrical pageants, then the first thing we should ask for is like, okay, let's see the corpse. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, from there, just start digging in forensically and just trying to get as much evidence as you can to see, you know, when was the event, who was there. You know, I like with the Seth Rich thing, I always wonder when you have these, what I call theatrical murder events. Well, every other bloody place in the city is under like 25 cameras. Where's the actual videotape of the event?
Well, that's the funny thing. The police officers, according to the police report, at least what I read, is
yeah,
their cameras were operating. And what did Seth Rich say to the police?
Yeah, exactly. Where are the videos? And like, it's just like the plane that flies into the Pentagon. I mean, you know, you got 8 million cameras all over the place, and we get two frames. That's a red flag. You know, it just shows that there's something fake.
Or same with Oklahoma City, right? Remember the bomb?
Yeah,
videotapes and the FBI lost or something. They claim they're all being changed at the same time or something. That was their claim. And now that claim is false, because it's obviously false. That's how much contempt they have for the public. And there's no, you know, there's no, the reporter should be there. The skeptical reporter should be there, ask these questions. But these reporters are all controlled. And if you're not controlled, your career doesn't turn out too well. You end up like Gary Webb, you know, with two bullets in your head. As opposed, you know, if you do play the game, you end up like, you know, you'll be like, Bob Woodward or something with a mansion in Georgetown, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you can plug in, and if you're in the guild and, you know, come up with fake news, and you'll be a superstar. But for the citizen researcher, you just have to assume that everybody in the media that is presenting information is controlled, mm-hmm. right? So you can't use any of them as information sources. And you need what we need to do is basically come up with a checklist of things that we can do, that the citizen researcher is capable of. And then just, you know, time after time, whenever these events, which are media, theatrical, you know, cultural movers, occurs, then you start setting up a kind of a checklist of the events. And then as researchers, you know, find more and more out, they can just keep adding to it. And it should be clear, you know, I mean, like, there's really a way to design this right, so that we can, you know, make real quick and real progress, and then people can come to it, and then they can look at this stuff and they go, man, it's 99% sure this is a false flag. And they would know that very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then that would become the real news. I mean, people would realize that, hey, this is actually coming from real reporters Right. Not the not the lifetime actor.
Yeah. So, yeah, not the the glamorized bleach blonde or the man with the coiffed hair with the strong chin, sonorous
Oh,
voice,
they, I
whatever.
mean, I don't watch mainstream media, so I've kind of lost. I mean, I know like O'Reilly and Hannity, but Wilf Blitzer, but everyone, I just don't watch it anymore. I only watch it if I have a particular, research purpose for like watching a show, but they just all seem absolutely fake at this point. They seem hysterical, frankly.
Okay, well, you want to call it a day?
Yeah, let's just end it right there. Tim, thanks so much for this discussion. And next week, I'm sure we'll have more terrorism and more government malevolence to report on.
Yeah, never, never, never want for material, unfortunately.
That's right. No absence of material. And I hope that people who read or listen to our show will help us by making suggestions as to how to get the false flag checklist reporting process, going, because I think it's a good idea. We should have websites that have analysis of this, how to do it, and take back reality to
Take back
use an
reality
expression.
night.
Yeah, it's right. We're going to take back reality. So,
So, okay, well, Joe,
all
I'll
right,
let you
Jim,
go.
thank you so much, brother.
Yeah, enjoy your holiday weekend.
Thank you. So, you too. Talk to you
Bye-bye.
soon. Bye bye.